doctored eye care from the same local doctors that you've trusted for decades. Vision Point Eye Center, clearly you. Now open at 1107 Airport Road in Bloomington. More information at visionpointeye.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Some educators say points-based grading might be pointless, that it encourages only enough effort to get the grade.
If we begin approaching our schoolwork and say, hey, I want to make this the highest quality it possibly can be, that just stands to benefit us in all walks of life.
Illinois State University Professor Jay Purcell tells WGLT correspondent Brianna Groh all about his TEDx talk. Plus, Ryan Denham reports the next generation of educators still in high school themselves shrug off talk of a teacher shortage during a conference at ISU. A new restaurant opens today in Bloomington Normal. We talk with the owner. And the Illinois Politics Roundtable tackles a doom and gloom budget report.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The school week begins today in Chicago with another day of canceled classes, affecting around 300,000 students. The Chicago Teachers Union went on strike October 17th. Their walkout has turned the city, state, and country's focus to teacher pay, class sizes, and other issues that impact educational quality. Those same issues were on the minds of many at the recent Future Teachers Conference at Illinois State University. WGLT's Ryan Denham was there and brings back this report.
There are lots of good reasons to become a teacher. It's rewarding. The kids need you, and because of a teacher shortage, the state needs you too. But Shemaine Bertrand has an even better reason. Teachers are powerful.
A lawyer can't be a lawyer, a doctor can't be a doctor, a surgeon can't be a surgeon, a plumber can't be a plumber. Nobody can be anything if they did not have a teacher. So we are powerful, right?
Bertrand is an assistant professor of elementary education at Illinois State University. She spoke this month to 350 high school students visiting ISU for the Future Teachers Conference. The event was part informational, part pep rally for a profession that many feel has an undeserved bad reputation. That reputation is one cause for a complex teacher shortage that's being felt statewide. There are around 1,800 unfilled teacher positions in Illinois, with concentrations in special education, English as a second language, and the STEM fields.
We have a problem in Illinois. The problem is we need more people to enter the teaching profession.
That's State Senator Jason Barrickman, a Bloomington Republican and ISU alum who spoke to the high schoolers.
And so I'm enthused by the fact that I can look out and see all of you who at this point have raised your hand and said, hey, that's something I might be interested in.
High schoolers at the October 18th event spent the day learning about what it's like to be a teacher or a college student training to become one. Sessions covered a wide range of topics, including international teaching opportunities, high-demand teaching fields, and what it's like to work in urban schools. The conference took place on day two of the Chicago Teachers Union strike, which has canceled school for more than 300,000 students. It follows months of negotiations between the union and Chicago Public Schools that failed to resolve disputes over pay and benefits, class size, and teacher preparation time. The strike was on the minds of several attendees, including Samir Data. He's a senior at Neuqua Valley High School in Naperville. He wants to teach high school, focusing on math or hands-on stuff like engineering or automotive skills. Data says he wants to teach because of an urge to give back, to repay what his teachers did for him. He's also informed. He's followed the new state law that will raise the minimum teacher salary in Illinois to $40,000 by the 2023-24 school year. That's one way the state is trying to cut into the shortage.
It's lessened my worry about pay because like I want to have a family, I want to support them, but at the same time, being a teacher isn't that like money, you know, that you don't get as much money. So I'm a little worried about that, but I feel like I can get past it.
Shemaine Bertrand, the ISU professor, also spoke to conference attendees on the pay issue. She says the profession is the most rewarding job ever.
While I don't drive a Lambo, I'm okay because there's something that happens in these classrooms that I can say I gave them that experience so that they can be better.
Teaching is rewarding, but it's also demanding. Daniel Jackson is a recent ISU graduate who's now teaching second graders in Chicago public schools. He spoke on a panel with other current and future educators at the conference.
There's an injustice. You can't ignore it. The students won't ignore it. They're going to bring it to you.
Jackson says the social-emotional needs of his students stretch well beyond his lesson plans. He says the good teachers dive into uncomfortable situations and talk to their students about challenges in their personal lives.
You want to be able to inspire them. You want to be able to give them something that you needed as a child. And that's something that I've learned from my teachers. They gave me what I needed, and then they moved on with the curriculum.
Britta Warren is a senior at Normal West High School. She was one of the attendees at the Future Teachers Conference. She's already sold on the idea. Her mom was an elementary school teacher, and Warren wants to teach special education. It's a safe bet for her. She began working with the special needs ministry at her church as a sixth grader.
I loved the fact that the kids, they don't really care about what other people think of them. They just care about having a good time and being themselves, and they're always looking to have a good time, and they don't really care about what a lot of people worry about most of the time, which is just such a relief to have to work with kids that want to just have a good time and want to love others more than I think most people do.
Warren says she learned a lot at the ISU Future Teachers Conference, and she appreciated the encouragement about the profession. And on paper, Warren's job prospects look pretty good. According to an Illinois Regional Superintendent survey from last year, there were over 800 total special education openings from pre-K through 12th grade.
I would say I'm pretty much all in, but there are certain things that I've heard that it's just one worry for me is finding the right fit in a school district. I know that teaching is a big team aspect, especially nowadays, so I feel like finding my fit in a good team would be a slight worry of mine.
About 1 in 4 new public school teachers in Illinois graduated from ISU. College of Education Dean Jim Wolfinger says ISU now has around 4,600 students pursuing education in some form. That's been steady the last few years, but is down from historic highs.
As we look to the future and thinking about what are the needs of the state of Illinois, we need to be sure that we are focusing on things like special education, English as a second language, STEM fields, and thinking about those programs as well as our traditionally strong programs like elementary education, early childhood education, middle school.
Beyond addressing the shortage, Wolfinger says the college is working to also diversify its student body and therefore the teaching profession. Unit 5 and District 87 here in Bloomington-Normal are good examples. In Unit 5, for example, 65% of students are white, but 93% of teachers are white. In District 87, 89% of teachers are white, while just 47% of students are white.
We don't see the teaching workforce mirroring the demographics of the state, so we're working on outreach to try to get more students from other backgrounds to come into education as well.
ISU was founded originally as a teacher's college. Wolfinger says ISU still plays an outsized role in making sure Illinois' education workforce is adequate to meet its needs. So what was his goal for the 350 high schools in attendance at this conference?
I would want them to be invigorated by the idea of becoming a teacher, that this is an exciting occupation. It's something that every day you can go out and do something good in the world. If they can come out of here thinking that teaching is a viable profession for them, an exciting future for them, and Illinois State is a great place to study, then I think we'll have accomplished what we want to with this event.
Reporting from the Future Teachers Conference at ISU, I'm Ryan Denham.
Illinois State University hosts several conferences throughout the year for educators, including the new Teachers Conference for graduates with 1 to 4 years of experience under their belt. That takes place every summer.
Support for GLT comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The CPB's Community Service Grant helps GLT bring you Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and other programming on which you rely for news, information, and entertainment. Additional support comes from GLT contributing listeners. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a gloom and doom budget report from the governor's office of the budget. That comes your way with the Illinois Politics Roundtable in just a few minutes. Let's stay on the education beat. Some educators believe there is no point to points-based grading and that students and teachers would be better off without it. That's what one TEDx Normal speaker will explore in his upcoming talk, Make Grading Pointless. Relentless, Eliminating Points to Foster Student Motivation. WGLT News correspondent Brianna Groh has more with Illinois State University Assistant Professor Jay Purcell.
I was teaching high school. I taught high school for a decade. And along the way, I just noticed students' incessant obsession with points. I remember distinctly one student asking me, you know, how many points is this worth in a classroom when I'd rolled out an assignment right towards the end of the semester. And I just thought to myself, like, why are we even doing this? Is it for points? Is that why I'm doing this? Or are we trying to engender actual learning here? And so just sort of as a way to reassign the value from obtaining points and storing up as many points as you can possibly get to actually learning the content.
Your talk also contains this element of fostering student motivation. So talk to me about the motivation component.
Right. I think that in the research that I've done and leaning on the research that's already been done in the field, assessment experts and certainly grading experts have found grading to be ultimately a demotivating process, where one might think that students would be motivated by external points, trying to gain as many as you can. But to a certain extent, especially in a points-based system, at some point a student could be kind of like mathematically eliminated from a certain grade, at which point in time their motivation just completely falls to zero.
I also hear talk about anxiety with today's students, how anxiety and stress are perhaps bigger problems for the crop of students today than in past generations. Do you think that this points-based system feeds into that at all?
I mean, I certainly think that it could. I haven't done any research relating to grades and points in terms of student anxiety. But yeah, I think that there is, to a certain extent, a level of competition just within school system or students striving to be the valedictorian or to get their GPAs up to a certain level that's way beyond 4.0. I remember some of my AP students when I taught AP Lit who, you know, literally the grade was the only thing that they cared about, because they were just chasing a GPA and they were chasing a valedictorianship. And I kept telling them, you know, there are more things that are also important. Sure, your grades are important. I'm not trying to say that they aren't, but there are other things that are, you know, possibly equally as important.
So talk to me about those things. What are students missing by focusing on that?
Well, those AP students, I would point towards letters of recommendation because they were all, you know, seeking these top colleges or whatever. But I think that that demonstrates just a level of relationship building or responsibility, you know, some of those qualities that maybe can't be measured, you know, out of 10 points, but are just as important. Networking, especially today in a social media culture, that, you know, you can network with people in various professions and various locations all across the globe. That's extremely important. It's tough to put a point value on that. That moment that I told you about where I remembered my student asking how many points it was worth, from that point on, with another colleague of mine, the now Dr. Lance Huffman, we devised a grading system. And my only goal at the time was just to take out all the points. And so we tried to sort of qualitatively assess students' work. And we developed a level of tiers that would work towards. We still had A, B, C, D, and F, ultimately. But there were no more points associated with it in an effort to, like I said, sort of shift that value and shift the focus away from just obtaining as many points as possible to how do I make the quality of work that I'm producing the highest quality that I possibly can? Because ultimately, that's what's going to get me the best grade. And I think that if we begin approaching our schoolwork or any of the activities that we're engaged in and say, hey, I want to make this the highest quality it possibly can be, that just stands to benefit us in all walks of life.
Let's get back to this points-based system. How did this come about?
Yeah, historically, I believe it was Yale University was the first one to actually award grades, and they did so before the turn of the 20th century. But then early 20th century, most grades that were being given out in schools were just narrative grades. The five-letter grade system that was all based on points sort of arose as a response to just strictly narrative grading. And at first it was met with a lot of criticisms as far as being subjective, if you can imagine. Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of times, especially advocates for points-based grading system or advocates for percentage-based grading is because there's this perception that it's somehow objective or that it takes all sort of emotional or subjectivity out of the picture, when in fact, like, the earliest criticism of it was that it was subjective in nature.
And why is that?
That's because grading is a subjective activity. The whole process of a teacher evaluating students' work and assigning some measure of quality to it is subjective to that teacher's expertise or to their own background knowledge. And so it doesn't matter if you're using a points-based system or if you're not. Like, ultimately, grading is a subjective exercise.
And could it also be that the points-based system doesn't reflect any specific challenges that a demographic of students are trying to overcome?
Oh, very much so. And especially when teachers assign homework as a certain amount of points, you know, perhaps there's students that homework is just something that's, they may come from situations where completing homework is difficult to do, and that may have nothing to do with their ability to compute in mathematics or their ability to construct arguments in their narratives. There's a good chance that they can do all of those things, but maybe the process of completing homework and accruing a certain points isn't possible for them. And if that negatively impacts their grade, then again, the grade is not necessarily indicative of their ability.
And you're talking about maybe whether the student has the attention span to complete the homework or even environment where it's chaotic and they have other responsibilities or don't have the time.
Absolutely. I was thinking of the latter. But yeah, it could be the former as well. I've had teachers tell me that they've walked through commons areas in the mornings and they just see feverish copying of homework going on because students, again, are really chasing those points. And the process of assigning homework for a certain amount of points is actually subverting these students' learning activities. And rather than focusing on the knowledge or focusing on whatever the content or skills may be being presented, they're just rushing to try and generate some sort of written homework with nothing really behind it.
I'm Brianna Groh. I'm talking with Dr. Jay Purcell. He's an assistant professor at Illinois State University in the School of Teaching and Learning. His upcoming talk at TEDx Normal is Make Grading Pointless, Eliminating Points to Foster Student Motivation. You were just talking about seeing students furiously copying other people's homework. There's a learning process that's not happening there. So what kind of learning process do you envision?
My first thought was that there is a learning process that's happening there, but it isn't necessarily one that teachers set out to achieve, because the student is learning, hey, I've just got to do whatever it takes to get these points. I've got to do whatever it takes to get this percentage. So, I mean, most teachers that I know and most teacher candidates that I know don't go into the profession because they want to hand out a bunch of grades. You know, they go into the profession because they love their content and they want to aspire a similar love for that content in their students, sort of to pass on their knowledge and to pass on their passions.
Is there another model that you are proposing that you think could accomplish that?
Certainly, yeah. The one I'm particularly fond of, the one that I created with my colleague, Dr. Huffman. I don't know what to call it other than the no points grading system, which assesses by a measure of quality, and students work towards gaining marks of quality in specific tiers, which then ultimately sort of compute their grades, A, B, C, or D. But there's a range of alternative grading systems. There's minimum grading, which is that 50 is the new zero, or no zeros for anything. And a lot of times, especially teachers that have been doing points-based grading for so long, when they see that 50 is the lowest score you can possibly get, they sort of see that as giving you 50% for nothing. But minimum grading really is trying to sort of make grading more equitable. You can still fail if you do nothing and you get that 50%, but it's only 10%. You have just as much chance to get any of the other grades as, rather than the 100-point traditional system, which is almost like designed to set students up for failure.
If elementary and high schools were to implement this system, we still have colleges and universities who use grades as a point of acceptance into their institutions. So wouldn't there need to be those higher level reforms? Otherwise, it's a mismatch system.
Yeah, certainly that's something to take into consideration. Up until now, I've been talking about, you know, my system or the minimum grading, and those all still come out with A, B, C, or D. They would translate nicely to a final letter grade that you could submit to colleges for acceptance. It's just that they're sort of qualitatively redefining what it takes to get an A or what it takes to get a B, rather than just focusing on earning a certain amount of capital. More and more schools across the country are moving towards standards-based grading. I think it's kind of only a matter of time until, especially as more and more students move through our school systems that are being graded in a standards-based environment, that's going to be some really important information, I think, that colleges and universities will want to know, is exactly where are the students' strengths, exactly where are they weak or deficient in the learning process, where do we need to build up their skills. That could be really important information for admissions office to know right up front.
And you mentioned standards-based grading. What is it? Just give me a summary.
So standards-based grading is a response to the standards-based movement, where teachers are aligning and basing their instruction off of content standards, most notably Common Core state standards, but many disciplines, even those that are outside of the Common Core, their national associations will generate standards that they can use to teach towards. So then standards-based grading will assess a student's proficiency or mastery of those standards, standard by standard.
So it's similar to what you were talking about with having the tiers and separating different criteria out for students to be evaluated on.
Yes, absolutely, because standards-based grading will break the content down skill by skill and show you whether the student is proficient in the skill, whether they've mastered the skill, or whether they're still progressing towards proficiency. And if that's known right up front, like, you could see where you could supplement some instruction or build in some support for those students as they're moving, you know, into college or even grade by grade into senior year, into junior year. So that's some real important information.
What about teachers? Is there a benefit? If there are new standards and various aspects of evaluation, isn't that creating more work for teachers?
Well, I think that teachers are aligning their instruction to standards anyways, especially here in Illinois with the adoption of the Common Core state standards. Those are the governing orders of the day, or the sciences and their next generation science standards. You know, those are what teachers are teaching towards anyways. So I wouldn't say that it creates more work for those teachers. My personal opinion is that if you are going to be teaching in a way towards those standards, if that's what you're after, then standards-based grading is the best way to assess whether or not the students are achieving that.
And is there another benefit that teachers might get from this different kind of system?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that as students, we sort of think about grades as the end of the road, you know, the race to be completed. But really, they should be formative in their process. We should be using the grades. We should be using our assessment to inform the instruction that we have for our students moving forward. And if we have a grading system that's so specific that can tell us students' strengths and weaknesses on very specific skills, we can use that even more to refine our instruction, to hone it specifically towards where we need to build up our students' weaknesses and capitalize on their strengths.
I've been talking with Dr. Jay Purcell. He is an assistant professor at Illinois State University in the School of Teaching and Learning. His talk at TEDx Normal will be November 16th. I'm Brianna Grill.
This year's TEDx Normal event runs from 9 a.m. to noon, November 16th, at the ISU Center for the Performing Arts. You can find a full list of speakers and their talks online at TEDxNormal.net.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Investigative reporter Ronan Farrow has made the rounds talking about his new book, and he tells us the process hasn't been easy for him.
As I report on each of these stories, there are these very below-the-belt attacks. You know, Harvey Weinstein's legal threat letters to me are not, shall we say, Hallmark card stuff.
That's next time on Here and Now. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Catch Here and Now today at 1 on GLT, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from Zimmerman and Armstrong Investment Advisors, offering securities through First Allied Securities, member FINRA SIPC. Over 30 years of experience, reputable financial management with an independent perspective. Drake Zimmerman has been a proud sponsor of GLT since 1983. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a new restaurant opening in town. We'll talk with the owner, Bob Dobsky. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker's budget has released a five-year budget outlook for the state of Illinois. The Illinois Politics Roundtable chews on that subject this week. Sean Crawford moderates the panel with IPR State House editor Brian Mackey and Doug Finke, Capitol reporter for Gatehouse Media, who talks about what we gain from that report.
We gained another reason for the governor to plug the graduated income tax, basically. This is a report that governors have to produce. It's not something that's unique to the Pritzker administration. And the basic premise here was no new revenues, no significant budget cuts. What happens to the state budget in 5 years if we don't go down that path? And one of the kind of startling numbers is the bill backlog would grow back to more than $19 billion if something isn't done. Now, of course, there are steps that can be taken, so the budget can be cut. And, in fact, there's a line in this report that says currently agency directors have been told to plan, make contingency plans for 6.5% cuts to their budgets from a maintenance level. But basically, the Pritzker administration issued this report and said, look, here's another reason why we have to have this graduated income tax, because if we don't have it, we're facing some significant financial problems.
Well, of course, that was, I don't want to call it a scare tactic, but sort of something like that, and certainly promotion of the fact that he wants this graduated tax in place. What's been some of the reaction to this that you've heard this week?
I haven't, frankly, heard a whole lot of reaction to it. It was issued. I don't even know the extent that it got a lot of coverage elsewhere. It came out. People looked at it. I can't think. Kind of said, okay, and are moving on.
Brian, you expect to see some of this, some of the numbers that were featured in this report in advertising that we're going to be getting a lot of next year as we get closer to the election and people voting on this?
Oh, no doubt. I think that the governor's strategy is to paint a dire picture of the consequences if his and the Democrats' favored graduated income tax constitutional amendment is not approved. And frankly, I'm surprised you don't see more of this from Democrats when they are doing budgeting. I remember back when Governor Quinn was making his budget presentations, he would sort of brush off the not recommended budget because you had legally were required to present a budget that lives within the state means, and then sort of emphasize the ones where, well, if we do this, we could do that. You know, if we raise this revenue, we could expand this program, that sort of thing. I'm surprised that Democrats don't take this sort of dire warnings more more of a strong political message for them, because what political science research tells us is that while people enjoy the rhetoric of cutting taxes and reducing spending on the campaign trail, when you actually ask them about what specific areas of state government they should cut, be it elementary and secondary education support, higher education, universities, public safety, aid for poor people, nobody wants to cut. At least a majority of people do not want to cut. Often strong majorities want to keep those programs. And so it's just surprising to me that you don't hear more of a sort of budget doom message from Democrats more often. So I think that plays into this strategy.
But I think we'll hear that going forward, and especially as we go into next year as they craft a budget for the following fiscal year, especially if this report is, as it says, agencies have been told to talk about or to prepare for 6.5% cuts. That's a pretty good chunk of change. And so we may be seeing the governor basically setting up a scenario like we saw with Quinn, where he lays out a budget. This is what we can do if we have a graduated income tax. This is what's going to happen if we continue on this path with no additional revenues.
Doug Finke is the Capitol reporter for Gatehouse Media. With him on the Illinois Politics Roundtable were IPR Statehouse editor Brian Mackey and moderator Sean Crawford. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A big new restaurant is open in Bloomington Normal, and the Twin Cities does love its restaurants. Rob Dobbs had a soft open last week for select customers and is fully open as of today. Owner Bob Dobbsky was with McDonald's for 35 years. In this encore interview, Dobbsky says he wanted a different experience.
It was, you were held by the hand to develop your locations and open up a McDonald's restaurant. Everything was kind of done for you in that. Where are you going to locate the store? Who are you going to buy from? How are you going to market it? This and that. Where now that we're out of it, it was time for maybe take that white piece of paper and develop a whole new restaurant business from scratch.
Why did you still have the zest for restauranting? It's not an easy business.
No, definitely not, especially in the hiring aspect of it with quality people and hardworking and that work ethic that seems to be diminishing in our country. But we got out of the McDonald's business, and still having my own health and things going well. I'm not a golfer, and I'm not got too many hobbies in that, and plenty of time to do something. And I said, why, instead of sitting in a lobby of some fast food restaurant drinking coffee for 3 hours with a bunch of other retired people, might as well do something that can help the community and benefit the community.
So be honest here. Did your wife Julie tell you to get a job or get out of the house to keep you out of her hair?
Well, yeah, definitely. As busy as she is and as involved as she is with everything else going on, no, there, that could have been part of the reason in that. I'm an early morning person. I like to get up, and this was a challenge. And I said to myself, even the 35 years in McDonald's and that, what would it be like to start your own business? Because I go back to my family history where my dad started his own one-man meat shop back in 1938 from nothing in Chicago, Illinois. And I says, you know what? I wonder what he had to go through, and that's what I wanted to experience this.
Is it different? How different is it from what you were doing?
Oh, it's immensely different. Putting all these pieces together of, again, designing a restaurant and equipping it and hiring and marketing it, again, without that help of a world global company like McDonald's was, for that 35 years, this is way different. In fact, this has really opened my eyes to I knew construction costs and that, what they were going to be in that, but even buying all the essentials to open up a restaurant, meaning plates and smallwares and equipment and kitchen, and to develop this fine dining type of restaurant and that, was just amazing. So,
are there similarities between fast food and fine dining at all?
Yeah, I definitely think your entry level positions, as far as with the employees and that, with whether it be a cashier at a McDonald's counter or a server in a restaurant, it's a lot similar. The managers, even the hours spent in the type of business, where Friday and Saturday are your higher volume days and that, I think are pretty parallel to what, you know, McDonald's and that, with a full menu restaurant. But even in this case, dealing with alcohol, with adult beverages, has been a huge difference and a learning experience for us. Getting our certificate for the Bassett certificate to serve alcohol, and buying the wines and the craft beers now that are there. But that's been a whole new experience. So,
is that fun?
Oh yeah, no, definitely. There are more days that are fun than there are some days when you ask yourself, why didn't I just stay retired and invest the money and go from there? But it, I'm sure at the end of the day, at the end of the tunnel, it's going to be a delightful experience, because I am enjoying it. So,
are there commonalities in quality control or staff turnover or anything else between the two fields, fast food and fine dining?
Well, I think, again, having spent 35 years in McDonald's and with their guidance and their, basically controls in place of, you know, the quality of food and the consistency, and, you know, working with the Board of Health and maintenance and whatever, we're just instilling that in this team that we're building, and our employees, our managers that we've hired already, and that to basically, and it still has to follow the same type of guidelines that McDonald's was in fast food, as this, you know, full menu restaurant's going to be about, you know, a speed of service of again, the health department rules of quality and cleanliness and all that. We're trying to instill that in this whole team that we're building in that. So, yes.
Does being in Bloomington Normal and starting a fine dining restaurant present its own special challenges? Are there unique things to this marketplace?
Well, the uniqueness about this market, as Charlie, you're well aware of, how many per capita that people eat out quite a bit, and then with our current economic position here, with, you know, State Farm, Country Companies, two major hospitals, Illinois State University, Illinois Wesleyan, and hopefully some more industry coming in here, people just don't have time sometimes, and eating out is a factor that, you know, a lot of similar size communities don't have, like Bloomington Normal and that. So I'm banking on that we'll be able to compete in that arena. So,
the owner of Jim's Steakhouse, a longtime high-end eatery in Bloomington Normal, has said when you open, he's counting on having a pretty slow fall, as Bloomington Normalites are typically flocking to the new person on the block just to try it out. Is there long-term room for you both, or for the number of high-end places in town? Will we see attrition?
No, I think there definitely is room for all of us in that. But just like he said, whenever a new place opens, we've had a couple that have opened up recently here, you see that thrust of, you know, total, you know, can't get a seat in a restaurant, can't get a dinner in that. But, and that'll happen when we open up ours in that. But like Jim's Steakhouse has been here for so many years, has a high, you know, standard and a high quality experience there when you go to eat there and that. And they've established themselves that, again, they have their regular customers, as eventually as we stay open and build up through the years, we will have our regular customers. But I think there's room for everybody, yes.
What do you want to serve?
Well, it'll be a full menu: steaks, seafood, pasta, salads, again, appetizers, a variety of different, you know, pork and chicken, of course, and that. But it's going to be an American menu, basically. So nothing specifically, but high quality, the steaks and seafood. That's what I've heard in the going through this process around the community, that we need a more extensive seafood choices in that going to restaurants. So we're hoping to bank on that and bring into the community some more seafood in that plates.
Will there be signature dishes? I've heard meatloaf.
Meatloaf, liver and onions, chopped steak, just to name a few there in that. But yeah, there will be a fish and chips in that. But again, we have to be affordable for all the different dynamics of this community, for families, for business meetings, for all the palates around the community in that. So we got to be competitive in our prices and make it affordable for everybody. So.
Are restaurants going to survive the way they have for the last century or so in this era of internet takeout and delivery? We're starting to see that, you know, DoorDash and a number of other delivery services pick up for restaurants. Is that going to be the default for the busy people who no longer have time to cook at home, who typically have gone out? Are they going to move to ordering out?
I think that's definitely on the horizon here, because besides just what you described there as far as the pickup and order and that, even your full menu restaurants in town here are having now call ahead, pull up to the curb, just call us at the restaurant and we'll bring it out to you and that. So along with the fast food, of course, with the Uber Eats and all these other different little delivery services. So I mean, that's a changing culture that we're going through right now. But I still think our restaurant's going to bring to this community an ambiance and a setting where you're going to want to come in and sit there and eat. With our bar that we are building, we're going to have a piano bar there with a baby grand Steinway piano in that. It's just going to be a little more, not a what you would call a sports bar in this community and that, but somewhere where you can sit there and relax and enjoy your food and have a conversation without yelling and trying to hear each other over it. So,
well, that's something to talk about, the acoustics. I mean, there are a lot of restaurants that try for a bright, lively atmosphere, and they have hard surfaces, so the conversations bounce off, but it's a fine line. If you get too noisy, then it's hard to have a conversation and you lose that trade. How much attention are you paying to the acoustics, and how quiet do you want it to be?
Well, that, again, definitely how I designed the restaurant and how I laid it out is it's not just one big room where, you know, a bar in the middle and dining all around and all that. We're going to have like three separate dining rooms in it, a separate bar area and that. We're going to have fabric and other carpeting and that in it. And even at the ceiling, the old-fashioned metal ceiling that you used to see in restaurants and bars, that's going to be, I'm being told that it's perforated and it'll be able to absorb some of the sound and some of the noise. So we're trying to get to that point where we can minimize as far as the loudness of restaurants. So.
What do people in this day and age, what do customers like for decor? Do they like the bright glitz of an ancho and agave? Do they like the homespun plainer decor of the late lamented Beningos? What's the trend?
Well, I think that's what we're going to find out here pretty soon in the next couple months when we open our doors, is because we're going to have, you know, a very nice decor of different, you know, local stuff, even pictures and artifacts and some of the old Bloomington Normal historical places. But even like Norman Rockwell's we're going to have up in there, Americana, but some abstract, you know, artwork in that. And it's going to be a lot of different things that'll be conversation pieces, let's say, in that, but not just one big, jump from one dining room to the other. We're going to have also, I mentioned the, I haven't mentioned the patio outside. We'll have a room for about 65 seats out there for an outdoor patio overlooking Hershey Avenue and that. So, but it's going to be a little different. So then your, again, your sports bars with 85 TVs around and that. We'll still have a few TVs in the bar area and that, but it's going to be a little nicer and I think something lacking in this community.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Bob Dobsky, whose new restaurant, Rob Dobbs, is opening on the east side of Bloomington. Are we in an era where friends dine, or is it still mostly family dining together? What's the role of the restaurant in the social makeup of our community?
Well, I think, you know, restaurants as is taken over from when families, let's say back in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, would sit at home around the table and cook the meals and that, or even have breakfast and that. This is what our culture and our society has switched to. So I think it's not just families, but it's going to be, you know, even for friends and business meetings and that, and that's what everybody looks for, is to kind of break bread and have a drink or two or something and just discuss things and that. And that's what we're hoping that our restaurant's going to provide for the community. So
260 seats seems a lot, is it? I mean, how does that compare to the regular size restaurant or average size restaurant in Bloomington Normal?
No, I definitely, that's right in a ballpark with the other, you know, full menu restaurants in town and that. So that we kind of looked at that and didn't want to you know, overextend it, but didn't want to short ourselves either. In fact, when I first started thinking about this, I actually thought about a second floor to being right next to the airport there and something to have an upstairs like bar area and that. But with construction costs and when we started getting into the numbers, we says let's start out with just one level and that's it. So,
how much is this restaurant costing to get up and rolling?
I haven't even got the final number in that at this point, Charlie, but, you know, the brick and mortar, I think it's been reported already somewhere around $3 million, and that's the other amazing thing about a fast food franchise getting into and what it costs to open that up with, you know, paper plates and wrappers to wrap sandwiches as opposed to buying plates and silverware and small wares and cooking stuff and that.
Here's a question about market size. In big cities, there are enough high-end restaurants so that there can be enough jobs for a professional server class, for really accomplished servers who get all the nuances of interacting with diners and who are socially polished and adept at the really small details that make for a notable experience. In Bloomington Normal, some of the restaurateurs I've talked to said not so much. There are a lot of college kids, but they lack finesse. They're young, after all. In opening a high-end restaurant, is that a challenge?
Oh, that's definitely a challenge in that, but I think we've hired about 90 people or so far, 95, and we're looking to hire a total of about 120, 130 people. But I think we've gotten some people that have actually worked up in Chicago, in St. Louis, in other, you know, even in Peoria with the higher-end restaurants and that come with some of that experience in that. So we've got a few of those in that. But that is a challenge. But I think with our initial five manager team here, we have our executive chef, our general manager, our bar manager, two assistant managers in that. I think they bring that experience in all of their past employers in that and where they've worked to develop all this with new people coming in. So,
training routines are tough.
Young people that are even 14, 15-year-olds we would hire in McDonald's and that. The restaurant business, whether it be fast food or full menu, is a good place to develop a work ethic, pride in your work, whether you're sweeping a floor, whether you're mopping a floor or putting away dishes or picking up the trash from the parking lot, to learn that responsibility for a young person. And over the years that we've hired people here in Bloomington Normal, and that people come back and say how fortunate they were, or even parents of kids that work for us, and said how beneficial it was for their children to start working and have that work ethic in that. And I think there's still a restaurant provides that for young people. Yeah. Training is very tough. Again, we want to build this family of employees that feel like they take ownership in this restaurant. And that was our success in the McDonald's here in town. And we want to, you know, bring that over into Rob Dobbs' restaurant, that whole entire experience, not just the menu and the food, which is critical to it, but also the service, the friendliness, the cleanliness of it, the whole ambiance of it, the whole experience that the whole team provides for our customers. So,
Bob Dobsky, thanks so much for talking with us.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Charlie. Appreciate it.
That's an encore edition of the interview with Bob Dobsky. Rob Dobbs has 260 seats inside, 65 seats on the patio, and is open for lunch and dinner on the east side of Bloomington. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, which today came from Ryan Denham and Brianna Groh. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.